This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Welcome to the License to Kill edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Bond. James Bond.
Trump. Donald Trump.
Donald Trump's lawyer contends a president has the right to break the law without facing criminal prosecution, even if that means ordering a political assassination. Trump resurrects an oldie but goodie lie. In 2015, it was Barack Obama who wasn't a real American eligible to run because he was born in Kenya. In 2016, it was Ted Cruz, challenged for being a Canadian. In 2020, it was California-born Kamala Harris, challenged because her parents were immigrants. Now it's Nikki Haley, who he claims is disqualified because her parents weren't U.S. citizens when she was born in South Carolina. Meanwhile, Trump refuses to sign an Illinois election pledge not to overthrow the government. And the first actual voting in the 2024 presidential campaign is coming up this Monday.
I'm Mark Brewer. In Michigan, the latest polling shows potential trouble for President Joe Biden and a statistical tie in the U.S. Senate race. A circular firing squad, once known as the Michigan Republican Party, has become a total mess, with two factions, both claiming to be the real Republican Party, with no headquarters, two separate websites, each claiming they are the official website, and the Republican National Committee refusing to step in. Leaders of that MAGA-centric party want to eliminate primary elections in Michigan for their ticket, leaving decisions to a handful of party activists. In other developments, a federal court has given the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission just 3 weeks to come up with a new legislative map for Southeast Michigan. One-time Trump critic Mike Rogers has done a complete 180 by endorsing Trump in hopes of boosting his chances to be the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate. And Bill Schuette Jr. says he's not running for Congress in the 8th Congressional District, a blow to Republicans' chances to flip that district.
Well, Mark, let's start with the polling that was from the Detroit News this week by Glenn Gariff Group and our friend Richard Schuba, who's been a guest on this podcast. They're one of the best pollsters in Michigan, along with our sponsor, Epic MRA. What this shows right now is some very troubling numbers for Joe Biden and the Biden campaign. What's your take on it here as we sit 299 days before Election Day?
Well, several things, Jeff. First, I want to start with how disappointed I was to see the Michigan Democratic Party trash Zuba. As a longtime Republican operative, certainly in the past, he's done work for Republicans. But as you just pointed out, he's a very well-respected pollster, and I think that was the wrong approach for the party to take. I think there's some interesting issues as you dig through the polling data. Still a fair number of undecided voters. I've not had a chance to dig into the crosstabs in terms of who those people are, but I think there's potential there to help Biden. I really wish somebody would do a poll in Michigan about our Arab American and Muslim population, a statistically significant poll. I'm not blaming Zuba for not doing that, but that is a population that's obviously been very troubled, and we've seen a lot of anecdotal evidence that they've said, look, we're done with Biden. We may have supported him in the past, but what's going on in the Middle East is intolerable for us, even if it means electing Trump with all of his anti-Muslim, anti-Arab American rhetoric and actions and conduct when he was there. So I'd like to see that data. And that may explain some of what's going on in terms of Biden here. But look, Biden's the incumbent. And when you're the incumbent, good news or bad news, you get blamed. And people are still anxious. They want things to come back to normal. Inflation seems to be coming down. But I think that's still a factor in people's dissatisfaction. I think the president is really going to have to engage. And he started to do that this week. I think he gave two really terrific speeches this week. And I think a lot of this is going to come down to attacking Trump and just really driving up his negatives under whatever swing voters are left. And also on the Democratic side, really motivating our base, which I don't think is motivated at the moment enough, to turn out and vote for Biden. Whether that's young people or African-American voters, this is going to come down to a turnout election, as you and I think have both discussed. The parties are so polarized now. There's so few voters in the middle. They're still there. and you and your Lincoln Project and other groups and the Democrats too, try to appeal to them, peel them off from the Republicans to vote for Biden. But I think this is going to be a nail biter. And anybody who assumes Biden's going to get reelected and thinks we can just coast to victory has another thing coming. So at least I hope this poll may have been a wake-up call for people inside the Democratic Party. But Jeff, I think you've had a chance actually to dig into the data a little bit more than I have. We welcome your views. What do you think?
I agree with your assessment. You just said a wake-up call. I think certainly the pro-democracy coalition in this country, which wants to prevent Donald Trump's return to power, needs to be concerned about numbers like this. But the panic that seems to ensue on the Democratic side when numbers like this arise, I don't think is warranted. This is not a harbinger of what is to happen. This is a harbinger of what could happen. And there's plenty of time for the Biden campaign to take some corrective measures when it comes to their focus and their messaging. And I think the president started doing that with his speech in Pennsylvania and the follow-up one in South Carolina on the bigger issues of democracy, on what kind of future we want for this country, the dystopian MAGA hellscape that's represented by Donald Trump, or the quest to be a more perfect union that striving for the more shining city on the hill. I think it might sound alarming to some, but Biden's speech was very reminiscent of the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan, aspirational about the ideals of what America in the United States represents. Not that everything here has always been great or is great today or couldn't be better, but it's that aspiration to be better than we are today in the future. And the positioning, I think it is a future. We have two old candidates, both roughly 80 years old. Talking about the future might seem kind of silly, but Donald Trump's campaign is entirely about the past, his vengeance, his grievance, what is changed, what is wrong, what is not the fictional Leave It to Beaver white suburban existence that his voting bloc has conceived of their fictional past. I saw David Axelrod interviewed in a publication as I was doing my morning reading today. And he said this is a race about the future versus the past. And I agree with that. I really think that right now these polls show some softness, especially on the Biden side. But Donald Trump's numbers, even though his ballot test in this Detroit News poll was strong, his personal numbers are still very suspect. His favorable, unfavorable is the number of people who want Donald Trump to be president. Again, those are still some soft numbers. And at the end of the day, this is going to be a binary choice. A good number of voters right now still think that there could be a Republican candidate other than Donald Trump and or a Democratic candidate other than Joe Biden. I don't think there's any chance that will happen. The race will be a choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And people are going to have to look deep within themselves and decide whether or not they love Joe Biden, like Joe Biden, agree with Joe Biden. The Muslim population in Michigan has to decide they have Joe Biden or Donald Trump. We know the historic parallels here. Choosing somebody they know is wrong, worse for them, to prove a point to Joe Biden is the height of insanity to me. It's like the young communists in Germany in the 1930s choosing to die on the hill of their smaller communist party rather than give their support to the social democrats that allowed the Nazis in part to rise to power. That's what can happen here. And that's part of the message that needs to be conveyed to a wide swath of voters. You don't need to love the choice, but this is the choice.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you make some really good points. There's all kinds of events to come in the next several months. I got the New York trial regarding Trump's business misdeeds, which seems to be coming to a conclusion. The special counsel prosecution, there may or may not be a trial before the election there. We'll see which direction the Middle East conflict. Yeah, I think we need to remember that one of the first actions Trump took when he became president was the Muslim travel ban, which provoked many of us to actually go to airport to assist people and to protest that ban. That and worse will come if Trump is reelected. And so there are real consequences here, not just for that community, but I think for a lot of other immigrants and even second generation immigrant communities in this country if Trump is reelected. And hopefully, I think as people accept the reality, as you indicated, Jeff, that it's Trump versus Biden and there are no other choices, that will start to sink in and people will start to think through the consequences of their choices. And that's just not for the Arab American and Muslim population. In terms of climate change, which is a big issue for young people, for example, the choice couldn't be starker. You can have criticisms, valid criticisms, that maybe Biden isn't going fast enough and so forth. But Trump will take us macro in terms of dealing with those kinds of issues. I shudder to think of Trump being president if we get into a confrontation with communist China over Taiwan or the South China Sea, or if we get into a confrontation with Russia over Ukraine. He'll abandon Ukraine in a moment. I get goosebumps, Jeff, as I sit here just reciting these possible terrible consequences of a Trump presidency. And I think that's got to be driven home over the next several months. But I want to turn to another aspect of the polling, Jeff. In the same poll, they polled the U.S. Senate race. And there were some interesting data there. On the Democratic side, it looks like Slotkin has a solid lead. But again, months to go before that primary. The GOP primary seemed a little more undecided, unclear at this point. Perhaps that explains why Rogers finally did what we all expected him to do and made the final sellout this week and endorsed Donald Trump. Everybody's falling in line, Jeff, as you have seen and you have predicted. And in order to appeal to that MAGA base, people like Rogers, formerly a staunch opponent of Trump, now endorses the guy. General election data there in that poll, neck and neck, but that's no surprise. Nobody knows who these candidates are, right? They've never run statewide, and there'll be a lot of money spent developing their name recognition and their issue positions. So that didn't surprise me to see that the general election polling in that race was neck and neck. There's a lot of development there. What's your take on the Senate results in this poll?
Well, I think that the general election ballot tests are not at all surprising. They essentially reflect the partisanship of the electorate. A little more than a third are siding with the Democratic candidate, even though a large number of voters aren't familiar with Alyssa Slotkin yet. A little more than a third of the voters are siding with the Republican candidate, whichever one is tested, be it Rogers or Meyer or James Craig. And roughly a third of the electorate is undecided. That kind of reflects the partisan makeup of Michigan's voters, with a large block, the plurality, calling themselves political independents. What sticks out to me is the step that Rogers took this week in endorsing Donald Trump, in doing so in a written op-ed in which he says things that Mike Rogers knows are untrue, that America was safer, the world was safer with Donald Trump as president than under Joe Biden, that our allies were more secure in their relationship with the United States than when Joe Biden was president. Mike knows all of those things are untrue. A friend who was a high-ranking operative in the Republican world in my Senate days back in the 90s when Mike was in the Senate texted me and said, "What the hell happened to Mike Rogers?" And my reply was easy. The same thing that's happened to every other Republican. They have set aside what they know is fundamentally wrong versus right. They have chosen to ignore that in their own thirst for personal power. That's what explains how Trumpism has taken root. Donald Trump could never have done this without people like Mike Rogers over the last 8 years bowing their knee to him in order to get elected. All it does is strengthen Donald Trump and his grip on the party. And these so-called people who say Mike Rogers is out there telling donors, "Oh, I've got to do this to get elected. But when I'm there, boy, I'm going to be just like the old Republicans." How's that worked out, Republicans? Let's look back at the last 8 years and talk about how that has worked out. They refuse to learn from history. And that, to me, is the most telling thing. The national security that Mike Rogers served in the U.S. Army, was an FBI agent, chaired the Intel Committee. He knows the dangers posed by Donald Trump. He knows them, but he's willing to jeopardize that, to take risks with America's future in order to get elected. And that tells me that he's left any bit of honor and character that he once possessed at the door of this election.
Yeah, Jeff, it sounds like we may as well adopt the Republican proposal to skip the primaries on the Republican side and just let the MAGA who are in charge of the Republican Party nominate their folks. Why go through all of this, if you're going to end up in the end with the same set of folks who are just loyal to Trump, notwithstanding their previous history.
Why settle for one dysfunctional state Republican Party when you can have two? That's next on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Ben Franklin may have invented the Franklin stove to stay warm, but we go Ben one better.
We have the Ben Franklin hoodie, dedicated to Americans for sanity.
But wait, there's more. Our merch store has coffee mugs for Democrats, uncrazy Republicans, and free-thinking independents, as well as t-shirts for the discerning democracy lover. Just click on the Merch Center link on our homepage, arepublicpodcast.com. Show your support for political sanity at the podcast merch store. It's your duty as an American.
Speaking of the Republican Party and this crazy proposal by Caramo to drop primaries, switch to an internal party process, taking us back to the party bosses of the 19th century, what's the latest on the internal Republican Party fight? And where do you think that goes?
I want to give a qualified expert who the hell knows. Since we recorded our last episode of this podcast, a faction of the state committee met for the purpose of removing Caramo from her position as chair. Caramo is challenging that. As I look at what happened last weekend with that special meeting of the state committee with that vote, it looks to me like Caramo, I hate to say this, but I might agree with Christina Caramo. What amounts to fewer than 40% of the state committee voted to remove Christina Caramo. Now, it was more than 80% of those in attendance at that meeting, but it was not three quarters of the state committee. And it seems to me that the bylaws are pretty clear in their plain language that it takes three-fourths of the state committee, not those who happened to show up that day and provide a quorum. They had a little more than half of the state committee show up and vote to remove Caramo. So it seems that she has a very legitimate claim that the meeting was illegitimate. She has said she's going to litigate. Her current co-chair, Melinda Pago, who is the temporary chair of the faction that met last week to remove Caramo, says they are going to litigate, that they now represent the actual Republican Party. I'm just sitting by with popcorn watching all this happen, as I know the Democratic Party in Michigan is, and a lot of folks who are part of the pro-democracy coalition watching this total chaos ensue on the Republican side. Here we are, inside of 300 days to go to the election. It's less than 10 months until Election Day, and the Republicans are just cannibalizing each other. And instead of doing the things a real political party would be doing, they haven't raised money in the last year. They're not getting ready to execute campaigns this year. They are a total bunch of dysfunctional, crazy amateurs out here fighting with each other. And I think that's ultimately going to be good for the pro-democracy candidates in Michigan, because in close races, be it for president or U.S. Senate or congressional races or legislative races, a strong, vibrant party organization with the grassroots volunteers can make a difference in close elections. And the Republicans just in no way, shape, or form are able to do that. And there's no way they're going to be able to right that ship in 300 days.
Yeah, Jim, I have some observations here as well. I thought it was very interesting that the words coming out this week that the RNC is staying out. You would think they would be a natural arbitrator or decision maker here, but the words coming out that they're staying out. It does seem that this meeting that was held last weekend had some procedural oddities. I understand that a vast number of proxies were used to create an ostensible quorum, and then the vote proceeded, as you indicated. There's an old adage in the law that possession is 90% of the law, and that seems to be where Carano is, right? She still controls what's left of the assets of the party, the website, email list, and so forth, and she's proceeded to kick people off who were part of this uprising, this insurrection last weekend against her. Jeff, I don't even know if they're going to agree which court they should have their lawsuit in. But I think that's where it's headed. Boy, if I were a judge, I don't know if I'd want to get involved in this. And there's some legitimate questions on whether courts should even be involved in this kind of internal party dispute. Right now, if this continues to devolve and we get separate Republican nominees presented to the Secretary of State after two separate conventions next summer, yeah, then maybe a court would have to get involved. But right now, I don't know, but we'll see. I think it is headed for the court. I agree with your analysis, and we've talked about this before, that strong political parties or political parties generally can play a role, an important role, in getting the vote out. But I would also caution my friends in the Democratic Party that while you may be laughing about all this, you should not relax your effort either. People and money are going to try to fill this vacuum. Right? We're in an era of super PACs, and the strength of the parties and reliance on the parties and institutions has weakened considerably over the last several decades because there are all these alternative vehicles, dark money, 527s, super PACs, et cetera, which will try, I think, to fill the vacuum here, help the State House Republicans, for example, regain a majority, help Trump, help the U.S. Senate candidate. So I agree with you that parties, I think, are still an important part of this. But these other players are going to try to make up the difference. And that'll be interesting to see over the next several months as well.
Even before the conventions in August, we're going to see now at the end of February, as we go into March, how this Republican dysfunction impacts the party, because they've got to pull off party caucuses to select their delegates for the national convention. They are only awarding a portion of their delegates based on the primary on February 27th. They've got to be in position, I don't know what the date is in March, but to carry off these caucuses. And without the party serving as the election clerk in that instance, they're not going to be able to do that. Are they going to have two separate party organizations, each claiming to be the legitimate party organization, having their own meetings? Are those going to be contested? There's going to be some chaos and dysfunction that manifests itself here very quickly.
Yeah, and that may mean the RNC will have to get involved and or the court. I think the last time we had that kind of fight in the Republican Party was in the late 80s, 88, I recall. There was a fight between, I think, the Robertson forces and the Bush forces, and ended up in federal court. So we'll see how this all plays out. But also today, Jeff, want to talk with you about the latest developments on the redistricting front. Here we are, February of 2024. And we're still talking about redistricting. Things are moving fast. The federal court issued an order this week giving the commission a chance to redraw the maps, but they have to have draft maps by February 2nd. Then they are to hold public hearing during the balance of February and finalize their maps by the end of the month so the federal court can review them. There have now been two special masters added to the mix. It's not uncommon to have one, but now there have been two. One who is going to review what the commission does in its maps and advise the court. And then the court has also appointed a special master to be a backup in case the commission either doesn't produce districts or they're not in conformance with the law. They've got a master on backup, basically, drawing districts that they will also then consider if the commission's districts don't pass muster. So it's a very complex situation. The commission itself just had three new people join. There's still a fight on the commission over at least whether one of the commissioners should be ousted. And they set a very ambitious meeting schedule. So this thing's moving very fast. It's very complex. Your observations, Jeff, I know I just gave a summary on the facts there. Any thoughts about all this as you watch it based on your decades of experience with Michigan redistricting?
Yeah, well, first, the one big question was answered this week between our last episode of this podcast, and that is there will not be special Senate elections, state Senate elections in 2024, as the plaintiffs in this case had wanted. That is off the table. There will only still be the battle for the House in Lansing on the ballot this fall. And so that is a significant development. If there would have been special Senate elections where control of that chamber was possibly at stake as well, it would have made this fall that much larger of a battle. It's still going to be a very big battle. But it really looks, I've quite honestly been surprised at the developments so far, that the plaintiffs in the case produced what they call demonstration maps showing a potential remedy for the state house, how those districts in and around the city of Detroit could be redrawn. And they kept those newly configured districts relatively contained, not the seven districts that were challenged and ruled unconstitutional by the federal panel, and a handful, two, three other districts, were the only districts that the plaintiff's expert in this case showed here's a potential remedy. And so the fact that those plaintiffs didn't go and do a further redraw in an attempt to also alter the partisan balance of the map was a bit surprising to me. Now, that doesn't mean that there other folks in this process now over the next month won't be pushing out maps that go beyond what those demonstration maps show, or that the commission won't go beyond that. But it's going to be very interesting to watch that play out. Are the alterations to the map that the current state house was elected in? And one question, and I don't know if we want to get into this right now, but how does the special election that's looming in that Lori Stone seat potentially alter what's going on here? Because that's not one of the challenge seats. But for example, in that demonstration map for the plaintiffs that they submitted to the court, they show an altered version of that seat. Would that create any havoc in the special election that's coming up?
Right. So, yeah, thanks, Jeff, for all that. Just one note for our listeners on the Senate elections. You made a very good point there. No special Senate elections this year. But those districts, the affected districts, the six that were ruled unconstitutional, will be redrawn for the 2026 Senate elections. And the way the court has staged this, that will come later this year. Once they deal with the House districts, they'll then move on. Well, I think we'll probably be a similar process for the Senate districts. But I think you put your finger on in terms of the House. The key question is, how many districts are going to be redrawn and which ones? As I've said in the past, I think you have too, but I'm not sure. I don't want to put words in your mouth. This can be done. These districts can be fixed, so to speak, within the boundaries of the seven House districts that were declared unconstitutional. So there's really no need to go beyond those seven. If the commission and or the court decides to do that, then as you point out, the question is which ones will be affected by it. On your special election question, I think the answer is these districts that are being drawn now are for the general election in the fall. The court's been very clear about that. That's the goal here. We're to get this done, all this withdrawing, by the filing deadline in April, so people know what districts are filing for the August primary and the November general election. Now, it could well be that whoever gets elected in that Stone seat, which is Warren in Detroit, could be running in a different district in November, but nothing the court said so far, and I think we're pretty far down the road here, affects the special election, which will be decided by late April, about the same time that the districts will be finalized, within a few weeks at least of each other. So that special election is proceeding, and the court has said nothing about it, and nor should it, frankly, because again, the goal here is to get these districts changed for the general election in November. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this a lot more over the next several weeks, Jeff, as this fascinating process continues to unwind.
Well, I can back up when you said that the remedy to the unconstitutional districts, those seven state house districts, I can say with certainty that you can draw districts within there, within that territory, in effect, no other district, no other territory outside of those seven. That's certain.
And that's a wrap for this week's podcast.
It's going to be one hell of a year. We'll no doubt have surprises hitting us every week between now and November, and perhaps beyond.
Jeff, and I can't believe it's only January 12th, and we've had all these political developments already, and the legislature just came back into session. We haven't even heard from them yet. But anyway, if the Republic is still standing next week, we will be back. Here's to a great 2024, and may the Republic survive this critical election year.
Trump. Donald Trump.
A Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.